followed by, now coming up, Loose Wig 8 Side 2.
When I first went to high school, I was interested in music, you know. So they gave me one of these alto horns, you know.
Brass, steel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So then I liked the baritone horn when my successor graduated. I went right in, you know. What's the name? Graduated. But, the baritone player before me graduated.
Graduated,
yeah. I took the horn.
Yeah. Well, is that a big brass horn that goes, not like a tuba?
No, it isn't as big as a tuba. It's got three valves. It's between a tuba and an alto horn. It's pretty big. When you hold it, you know, like this.
Wow. I can't figure you playing that. When did you get on reed then? When your mother gave you the saxophone, huh?
Yeah, well, I mean, I had the saxophone in, but it was loaned out.
Oh.
A friend of mine was playing saxophone at the time. He had a band, so he borrowed the horn. He kept it over 2 years. Too. He kept it maybe a year after I got out of high school. I got out of high school in 35. And,
the year after I did.
Yeah. And, all a gang of things happened there. I got the horn. Got married.
Let's see, when were you born? What was you? You're born in what? 1920. Boy, you're awful recent. Born 1980.
A whole lot of speed back then.
What happened in 36? You graduated from high school. You were playing saxophone by then, weren't you?
Mm-hmm. Married?
Married?
And then the gang
is in there,
yeah.
And this is all in Kansas City, huh? Mm-hmm. I was up through Kansas City in about 40, and I caught Harlan Leonard and Jay McShann out there. And I don't know, maybe you were with McShann then. And I've been kicking myself ever since, you know, I didn't do that.
Yeah, I was in McShann's band
over there. I can always do it
divine.
He was a
McShann didn't have a big band then, did he?
No, it was a little 718.
I was in that band.
You were?
I was in the plaza way out of Kansas.
Yes, we had to go outside of town to catch that band. And I heard that and I didn't know that. Yeah, you don't have to whisper, dear. There's no secret. It's not it.
We'll go on some more beer. We got to rush the beer.
Bring a glass for it, right? You got no idea where that tummy came from, man. That's
damn unusual, because that at that time was when almost all the kids about your age were so swing band conscious.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember that when I was in high school, we used to get a lot of the bands you mentioned tonight, Marshall, for dances, because they come out of New York City and you could get them in the middle 30s pretty cheap for one night. And so many of the guys you mentioned tonight, we bought Jimmy Lunsford for $210 for one evening.
The whole band?
The whole band. And there was Willie Stevens Bryant and when Tap Jordan, you remember, was playing one of the main broadcasts on Saturday afternoon. And the whole urge was everything were big percussive arrangements where everything was on the beat and all the high school kids who were playing in bands then, who had their little dance bands, would get the records, you know, and copy down and score so they could work on it.
They still do that.
They still do that, yeah. I imagine now they're having a much tougher time.
Yes, and ask her to tell you about that, because that's how it goes. They have those beanie hats. Tell them about the hat.
Is this your verse?
What is that, Charlie?
You know when they used to have hats for boys of that age called jelly beans?
Sure.
They had one. I had it.
Marshall,
his son
looks exactly like that.
Does he?
Exactly.
Gee, that's a wonderful picture. Long pants, too.
Yeah.
Very mature. I had a bunch of brown collar.
I used to wear a bunch of
You were 6 years old then, huh?
Yeah.
Did Lella get this from your mother?
Yeah, he wrote to her for that.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, he wrote
and that isn't you there, is it? Charlie playing tennis
back
to those times. Doesn't look like you.
It is
that isn't a picture I have, but that's the
time.
Picture I
saw.
Yeah, that's
me.
Does that look like Charlie?
Yeah.
Oh,
the lighting.
Pretty
thin.
Yeah, that's what
the lighting. One way.
Sharp. Somebody keeps moving that hat. This picture is better, though. Tell her.
Yeah, where is it?
What a story about that rubber-legged woman.
Well, he sure did that. The coffee's got confused some kind of way. And I was looking for the coffee that I had because I'd marked it the container, you know.
We had the coffee and
it was all in containers. They sent out for coffee and sandwiches in the container. It was all in containers, you know. Sandwiches. Everybody was eating sandwiches. So I set my cup down beside the chair and got the benzene in it, you know.
Yeah.
And I just waited for it to dissolve. I'll be all around. Somehow or another, rubber lady is hungry. He goes collecting coffee and he got some quick stuff with my hand. And about 20 minutes later, he was all over the place. Man, you never seen it. Ant don't do nothing to me. Rubber legs really got busy, you know what I mean? It was a funny thing.
Well, he was really singing seriously, but he wasn't trying to kid it, was he?
No, he wasn't, not a bit. And ordinarily, if it hadn't been for that, I mean, he'd have sang a different style altogether.
He would have.
Yeah. You ever heard none of his records when he wasn't?
No,
he's got records on when he was, you know, normal. You know?
You sing much smoother?
Much smoother.
No.
Well, isn't that Danny Brown's brother?
Rubberleg?
Isn't he, you know what I mean? He's in Europe now. So, I mean, Rubberleg.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
What's his name?
I know Danny. Danny, you're talking about. I don't know what you're talking about.
These records you made with the Tommy Young was on some of them.
Yeah.
Remember? And with All Stars and some came out on Manor and some came out.
On little.
Isn't that the one?
Some came out kind of label.
I can't get started. That was made that day.
No. Dream of You, Seventh Avenue.
Yeah.
Two other sides were made that day.
Was that all for the same company made that day? And then they just got them out in different...
Oh, that day was made for Continental, yeah. But I have seen some of those records out on the Manor label, I think.
I guess Manor bought some of the company.
Yeah,
show me
on day. You were?
I was more fun playing with the Heinz band or the X-Time band.
I think it was more fun playing with the
X-Time band.
The X-Time band.
But the Heinz band was much smoother. Billy makes a very easygoing leader, and everybody's having a ball.
Yeah.
You know, often I...
Oh, that's a wonderful band.
You heard it?
Greatest band ever.
Why, I couldn't have heard that. This Tiny Grimes date you made Red Cross and saw Nick Tiny Temple, they since put it out with your name on it.
They did?
Yeah. They figured it would sell more records, you see. It came out under Tiny thing.
They're not lost,
I don't know.
Yeah.
Reissued under Parker's name.
They're not supposed to do that, but I mean, Herman Lebrezki does a gang of things he ain't supposed to do.
All those guys do. It's the old story. You can copyright a label, but you can't copyright a performance. And once you sell your time that day,
He has 11 sets of books. Whoever wants these books.
Oh dear. Not like the old Irving Miller. Yeah. Well, Charlie, the truth is that Mop Mop was your idea originally. Leonard says here that Mop Mop was one of the things you threw off, and then finally, I don't know who, somebody else.
It could have been because we used to do that a long time ago in Kansas City.
You did Mop Mop in Kansas City?
Years ago. That was just put them drum beats in there just for the phone ball. We just play, and we used to channel, you know, just play sometimes. You know, just put it in.
Oh, would you like to see these?
Make a crazy mix.
Did you hear about Gene Rollins' band?
No.
Tell them about
it.
They had 8 reads.
Oh, yeah, 2017 band
rehearsal. How long ago was this?
About 3 weeks ago.
Do you know all those?
No. 8 trombones and 8 brass.
If you like.
Well, what label they record for, Charlie?
Just record. And here, Ann, Ann,
Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann,
Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann,
Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann,
Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann,
Ann,
Ann,
Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann,
Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann,
Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann,
Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann,
Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann, Ann,
Where were they made?
It was made in Nola.
Nola?
Gene has all the stuff recording all the time.
It's awful hard to record big sound in New York because there are so few rooms that are good.
You know, at first the theory was that they must have a very toned down room, something with a lot of soft things in it.
A real test. Absolutely test.
That's wrong, man. Because in Europe, they have much better balance on records than we do here. They record in old temples and old cathedrals and old churches, backyards, fence stand and everything, you know, with no acoustics whatsoever. Just nothing but a chamber, an echo chamber. And the records come out with a great big sound.
I mean, on these small rooms, I guess, particularly in the higher registers of sound, everything compresses. It gets squeezed.
The whole thing, from beginning to end, is a hoax. Are involved, by and large, in a very strange business system which divides your day into work and play. Work is something that everybody does, and you get paid to do it because nobody could care less about doing it. In other words, it is so abominable and boring that you can get paid for doing it. And the object of doing this is to make money. And the object of making money is to go home and enjoy the money that you've made. When you've got it, you see, you can buy pleasure. And this is a complete fallacy. Money never can buy pleasure, because all pleasures depend upon not putting down a symbol of power, money, but upon disciplines. And you have a strange feeling, you see, that the whole procession of grades that was leading to something in the future, to that goodie, that gorgeous, voluptuous goodie that was lying at the end of the line, it never quite turns up. And this is because from the beginning we condition our children to a defective sense of identity. And this, I think, is the most important feature in the whole thing, that a child grows into our culture, and as I repeat, this is not only Western culture, it's equally true in Japan, an area of which I can speak with some first-hand knowledge. We condition the child in a way that sets the child a life problem which is insoluble, and therefore attended by constant frustration. And as a result of this problem being insoluble, it is perpetually postponed to the future, so that one is educated to live in the future, and one is not ever educated to live today. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, the philosophy of carpe diem, let us drink today for tomorrow we die, and not make any plans. What I am saying is that making plans for the future is of use only to people who are capable of living completely in the present. Because when you make plans for the future and they mature, you are, if you can't live in the present, you are not able to enjoy the future for which you have planned. Because you will have in you a kind of syndrome, whereby happiness consists in promises and not in direct and immediate realizations.
Well, maybe you've never seen a happy zebra, see, but I worked in a circus, and of course this was a happy zebra for a while. Then the zebra got down with the mumps, and his jaws swole up, so the fellow that owned the circus decided to leave the zebra on a farm until his jaws went down some. And while he was on the farm, the zebra was curious because he'd never been on a farm before. And he bumped into a hen. He said, "Hello, what are you?" The hen said, "I'm a hen." The zebra said, "What do you do?" The hen said, "Oh, I just eat some corn and lay some eggs and pluck around." And the zebra said, "Oh," and he galloped off and he played in the meadow. And he ran into a cow. He said, "Hello, what are you?" The cow said, "I'm a cow." The zebra said, "What do you do?" The cow said, "I give milk, eat some grass, and moo." The zebra said, "Oh," and he galloped off and ate some clover and rubbed his side on the fence. He bumped into a bull. He said, "Hello, what are you?" The bull said, "I'm a bull." The zebra said, "What do you do?" The bull said, "You take off them fancy pajamas, I'll show you what I'll do."
This is so strange. Do I hate women?
Not at all.
No, of course. On the contrary, I would think just the contrary. What makes people ask that question sometimes is perhaps because I have depicted them pretty nakedly and brutally. I've restricted love often to the sex act. Do you see? Love as sex. Because I know better than anyone that love is something, it includes sex. But it's beyond it and bigger than it, don't you know? But in writing that book and even some of the other books, being truthful and relating only my own life and own experiences, I had to tell what happened to me. And those things weren't pretty. They weren't ennobling and so on. It does not follow. That is a strange mistake that critics make and moralists make and so on, to think that because an author chose to write or select or limit what he describes in his books, you see, as his experience, that this constitutes his whole experience. As a matter of fact, I have deliberately left out of my work all the other side, the better, the bigger side, out of a certain sort of pudeur, you might say, do you see?
A modesty.
Modesty, yes, in a way, yes, yes. I don't even want people to know about that, do you see? That's quite private with me.
Isn't that a writer's calling?
What?
To have no privacies in the heart?
Well, with a writer like me, it ought to be, especially because I've revealed everything. And yet, every man does keep secret and sacred certain things, do you see? And I'm that particular, peculiar type, I think, Ben, who has preferred to reveal the worst side of himself in his writing, because perhaps it's so little done, and people are so anxious to do the other, or to defend, or to justify themselves. I have certainly not tried to justify myself, do you know? Justify myself, yes, as a creative being, but not from any moral standpoint, do you see, ever. I make no defense of myself. I did these things. They're on the record. They stand or fall. Do what you like with it.
Anyway, let's get back to some more music here. If my notes here are correct, we're going to start off with an original by Sonny.
Thanks. This is a tune I wrote. The title is Always Merry and Bright. And it's kind of in honor of Henry Miller. There's a book written about Henry Miller called Always Merry and Bright, and that's his motto. He tried to make it be his motto. One, two, one, three.
Thank you.
Fosdick once wrote a book called How to Be a Real Person. And this, in translation, means how to be a genuine fake. Because the word person means a mask. The persona, the mask worn by actors in Greco-Roman drama, which was a megaphone mouth mask, so that through which persona the sound goes. And so at the beginning of a play script, you will see the dramatis personae, the persons of the drama, that is to say, the list of the masks that the actors are going to wear. But the word has so fallen from its original use that to be a person has come to mean your real identity, your true, sincere, honest self, the person. And we say of someone then, he's a real person. That means he's genuine. But we have confused, you see, the individual organism with the person, with, that is to say, its role. And we have defined the role of the person in such a way that it condemns everybody so defined to perpetual frustration. You see now here what's going on. You are required and commanded to do certain things which will be appreciated only if you do them voluntarily. Now you see, when your identity is defined by society, you cannot resist it. You don't have the knowledge, you don't have the wisdom, you don't have the resources to understand that something's being put over on you. You cannot but help believe the definition of you as a free agent. But you believe yourself to be a free agent as a result of not being free. That is to say, of being hopelessly unable to resist society's identification of you. So in the whole sense of our personality, there is a contradiction. And that is why the sense of ego, of being oneself, is simultaneously a sense of frustration. But that you are something not that comes into the world, but comes out of it. In the same way as a flower comes out of a plant, or a fruit comes out of a tree. That you are an expression. You, as a human being, are a symptom of nature. And that you really belong there, and that, furthermore, your actual self, what is finally and fundamentally you, is not a separate and lonely part of the world, but the real you is the world itself, everything that there is, expressing itself as this particular organism here and now, and of course, as you look across the room, as all these other organisms in their here and now, we are all tits on the same sow, if I may put it so crudely.
Was three moles down in a hole, and it was a mother mole and a father mole and a baby mole, and the father mole stuck his nose out the hole and he sniffed. He said, and I smelled biscuits cooking. And the mother mole stuck her nose out the hole and sniffed. And said, those are not biscuits, that's bacon. He said, what do you smell, baby mole? And the baby mole couldn't quite reach out the hole and he sniffed anyway. He said, I don't smell nothing but molasses.
From Chicago, which is the home of Downbeat, not too far from now. Do you have any plans at the moment about any future engagements?
Well, about future engagements, no, not any exact plans. I guess you heard I'm breaking with my manager.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I sent an item to Downbeat about that just last week.
Yes, well, I mean, after that, maybe plans can be made, but no, nothing special right now.
Well, let's talk about your recent trip to Europe, because I have a couple of records coming out by people you probably met over there, and I know you had a very interesting experience. It was quite a short trip, but a very eventful one. How long were you over there?
Well, I was in Scandinavia 11 days, and I was in Paris for 4 days.
Well, the Paris part was not for, actually, for playing, was it?
Just to visit? That. I went down strictly for a visit.
What did you do in Scandinavia? Who was with you there?
Well, in Scandinavia, I had the pleasure of working with Roy Eldridge along with a Swedish band. It consisted of Rolf Eriksson. I guess you remember him. He was here with Woody Herman.
Oh, I certainly do.
And some of the names I can't pronounce. Anyway, there were five musicians with me all the while. And then Roy had his own band, and he did his thing with. And I guess the things I'm accustomed to.
Yeah, and where is Roy Eldridge now? Is he back?
Roy's in Paris, yeah.
Uh-huh. Does he intend to come back here, or is he going to stay over indefinitely?
Well, I don't know. I think he intends to come back anyway. He has his ticket back.
Oh, well, that's good news, because we sure miss him. I got some records that he made in Paris. I want to play them on the show one day. I have one thing where he sings the blues in French.
Oh,
it's really something.
Yes, I think I've heard that.
Yeah? That's great. Well, while we're talking about that, how about cutting in for a moment for some music that comes from over there? James Moody is the chief musician on this next side. Did you meet him over there?
Yes, I saw him over there. I met him here at first, though.
Yeah, well, did you work with him ever?
No, I haven't.
He's a very fine...
Only on the concert in 1949.
Uh-huh.
In Paris, it was.
Oh, I see. Well, this is one of the sides that he made, I believe, in Scandinavia, and the title is Blue and Moody. It's the same musician. You know who Reinhold Svensson is?
Reinhold Svensson? Sure.
Tell me about it.
Well, he's a blind pianist. He's blonde, and he weighs about 235 to 40 pounds.
No kidding.
Very clever. Very good musician, very jovial.
He certainly is very talented, too. He made a whole series of sides with a quintet over there, I think, patterned after George Shearing, wasn't it?
Yes, yes.
Sounds very much like it. Anyway, we have one of those sides here. They just put out an LP consisting of 8 Reinhold Svensson numbers, and I think you'll like this one. Dearly Beloved. Say one thing about that record, it has a fine surface, a lot of surface, anyway. Well, the music is good. Well, Charlie, I would like to get your opinion on something. I read a very interesting article just a few days ago in Ebony Magazine under the byline of Cab Calloway. Did you read it?
Yes, Leonard, I saw such an article, and I've never read or heard of such a violent, contemptuous thing against musicians of today.
Well, that's a pretty strong statement. I think we'd better tell our listeners what the article is about.
Well, okay, let's tell our listeners. Let's tell them this way. If they should like to read the article, it's published in Ebony Magazine under the name of Cab Calloway. The rest will speak for itself.
Well, can I go into a few details anyway? Cab Calloway says in the article, or implies in the article, that the narcotics are ruining the music business, and he makes it very clear that he thinks a large number of musicians are using narcotics, and that... He goes into a great number of details about the thing, which we won't go into on the air, but anyway, it's a very provocative article. Would you say that it represents the true picture of the situation?
I'd rather say that it was poorly written, poorly expressed, and poorly meant. It was just poor.
Well, that makes it pretty definite. As a matter of fact, I'm inclined to agree with you, Charlie. I think the article was perhaps badly timed, and perhaps... didn't go into a careful enough examination of the real facts. As a matter of fact, it quoted something that I wrote several years ago about the same subject in Esquire, and it misquoted, or rather, made an incomplete quote that gave a wrong picture of my feeling about the thing. I certainly don't think that a musician necessarily plays better under the influence of any stimulus of any kind, and I'm pretty sure you agree with me, don't you?
Well, yes, I'd rather agree with you to an extent. I think you're quoting something that I once said to you.
That's right, exactly. You said that to me quite a while ago.
That's exactly right. Well, nobody's fooling themselves. Never. Anymore, anyway. We'll put it that way. And in case an investigation should be conducted, it should be done in the right way. Instead of trying to destroy musicians and their names, I don't think it's quite a good idea.
Yeah, well, I think that maybe Cab is going to think twice about whether it was a good idea to have that article appear in it.
He has already expressed his thought.
He has? You mean in the magazine?
That's
well,
exactly
that's true.
Right.
But I haven't talked to him since the article came out, and I'll be very interested to hear what he has to say about the musician's reaction to that article, because it's going to be a pretty violent reaction, just as yours is.
Well, would you expect any less?
No, as a matter of fact, you're quite right. I think it's bound to cause a lot of talk, and a lot of unfavorable talk, certainly. Well, Charlie, it's been very, very good talking about all these subjects with you, and before you go, I'd like to say that as soon as you have your plans set, please come up here and tell us all about it. Tell us who your new manager is and where your new bookings will be. And, of course, as far as what your new records are, we'll be keeping in touch with that and reviewing them as they come along. And I know they'll be all A's and B's.
All right, Leonard. Thanks a lot.
Try to avoid whether saying whether I'm an optimist or a pessimist. I'd like to believe there is something which is neither, you see, which is beyond the opposites. I think that's the real viewpoint, to get beyond.
Thank you.
when you say now, naturally, these are, yes, it is a bad time in the history of the world. Certainly it is. Terrible time. Yes.
Why terrible? Now we've been not being optimistic or pessimistic, but we're looking calmly and lovingly at the world, huh? You love the world.
I don't know. There's always, the world is generally used by way of comparison with something else. You know what I mean when you say a man is of the world and in the world or not of it? Do you see what I mean? In that sense, then the world comes to represent something which man fights, struggles against, do you see? He wants to be in it, but not of it. He wants to be above it, huh? Mm. However, I do believe, Ben, that the only way that you can prove that you are not of it is by entering into it fully. You cannot evade anything that is of this world. You must accept everything that belongs to this world and then prove that there is something more, do you see?
Do you mean you shouldn't have any feelings of good or bad? You got to accept everything? That mean you have no standards of accepting and rejecting?
No, I don't think I mean it that way. I mean that you should not fall a prey. You should not fall into the trap that the world presents. You should be able to enter it, partake of it, understand it, and yet know that what is moving and directing you, guiding you through life, is not altogether represented by the world in which one lives, you see. That there are other things that are invisible, inscrutable, intangible, that are not embraced in what we call the world. And,
can you be specific about these non-specifics?
Well, I suppose what I'm talking of represents what has been preempted by the field of religion. And yet I'm not a religionist, do you think? But, it's to say, let us put it very, very simply, when one says man does not live by bread alone, do you know what is meant by that? That's a very big symbolic statement put in a few words. What it means is that it isn't his success in the struggle for life, his getting bread, getting security, raising children, and so on, and all that enters into what we call life. That isn't what sustains him and supports him. It's something that you can't put your finger on. It's spirit. And you can't name it. It's you can't define it, do you see? It's bigger than everything else. It includes it all.
Can you sense it when you come in contact with it? In others?
Yes. Well, I think so. I think you're aware when you talk to people, there are those of poor spirit and those of great spirit, don't you know? None are without it, do you see? But the flame goes pretty low in some cases. You know, in many, many, I mean, the majority of people, it seems to be nothing but a little flickering flame, do you see? You know that when you put them up against a single individual who's all fire and all radiance, do you see?
A luz se fonda na patria, no jour de gloire et à l'hiver.